Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 342, we have the pleasure of bringing you the preview of the May 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. We discuss several topics. We start with the discussion of a paper about the concordance and discordance of patient and physician perceptions in the case of intravitreal injections for various retinal conditions. We then talk a little bit about retinal vein occlusion, including clinical trials and a discussion of laser therapy for retinal vein occlusion and diabetic retinopathy, and end with a brief discussion of uveitis. Thanks to doctors Greg Lee, Akshay Thomas, and Kat Talcott for joining me for this episode. Remember, you can find financial disclosures in the episode description, as well as a link to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on our website and on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. So thank you again, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the May 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, you can find Retinal Physician in print and online at retinalphysician.com. Joined by three colleagues for today's episode in alphabetical order. First time in the program, Dr. Greg Lee joins us from Atlanta. Greg, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Next, we have Dr. Kat Talcott, who's in Cleveland, Ohio.
Hey, it's nice to see you. Thanks for having me again.
And last but not least, Dr. Akshay Thomas from from Nashville, Tennessee.
Good to see you, Jay.
Yeah. So you know what I'm going to do? It's an inside joke you've heard before. I always forget where Akshay's from because my Tennessee geography is fuzzy. But I'll remember that you're where Steve Charles is not, because Akshay Thomas and Steve Charles are like mantra and antimatter. They just can't exist in the same. There's just not enough retina in one place for the two of them. So we're going to transition. So we have four articles here. Remember, our goal is not to be super comprehensive. We're just going to use these as jumping off points for discussion. The first article I thought was interesting is this article with the title Discordances in Perceptions of Shared Decision-Making Among Patients with Retinal Diseases and Their Care Teams, with the subtitle Better Communication Can Increase Patient and Provider Understanding. A slew of authors here, John Pollack, formerly president of ASRS as a first author, but a whole bunch of the retinal physicians contributed to this. And just to summarize, so they did a study where they looked at these patient-provider collaborative learning sessions at different retinal centers that basically serve patients who would be typical injection type patients, right? So your AMD, your DRDMA patients, and your COVID, excuse me, your RVO patients. They do discuss that they did use some of these in a virtual format, namely the DR and the RVO, because of the timing it had to be done virtually due to COVID-19. And so they did these sessions where they brought patient community people in, and it was, you know, not huge numbers, but pretty decent. They brought about 50 patients each for AMD and RVO and 120 patients for DRDME. And they had a number of different clinics that participated, and they looked at the number of years too that these patients had been seen for. It's like 12 years or so. And again, they broke this down by the people taking care of them. There's a mix of retinal specialists, nurse practitioners, nurses, et cetera. And they had the patients and the providers each sort of fill out surveys reflecting their kind of what they felt about their interactions with one another, which is always interesting to kind of do a survey. You do a survey of Akshay Thomas about his experience on the podcast. You do a survey of Jay Schreeder about his experience with Akshay Thomas as a podcast guest, and you get very, very different sort of answers back. It's always interesting because I think the whole other discussion I'll get to later is we all tend to lack a little bit of self-awareness, right? We all have blind spots, no pun intended. And so it's interesting because they broke this down by categories, because patients really talked about how they don't understand their treatment options, right? So that's like their number one thing is almost half the RVO patients, about a third of the AMD-DR patients said, I don't really understand why I'm being treated, which we'll get into whether that's surprising or not. To me, is not super surprising. Again, providers on their hand were saying, look, it's that these patients just don't want to be adherent. And when they talked about the lack of adherence and they broke that down, a lot of these patients said it's because they didn't feel like they got better, especially AMD and RVO patients versus the DR patients said side effects, which is interesting as well. Providers always think it's treatment fatigue, that patients feel that they're overtreated. And we'll get into how that's interesting in terms of what providers do as we go forward in the discussion as well. And then finally, that it's the idea is, do the patients and doctors both want to be involved? So doctors are like, you know, I think the patients really want to be involved in decision making. The patient's like, you know what, I actually don't really want to be involved. I just want to be told what to do, but I want to understand why we're doing it. Those were kind of the biggest things. So then these educational sessions that were done, I mean, they showed, as you will any educational study, you have to kind of show that before and after people understood more. That's pretty standard if you ever done any sort of educational study to any group. They did show that they, hey, you know, I do understand things more. I want to talk to my provider more. And you can see that the proportion of patients who plan to talk to the providers about their concerns went up. Patients felt more empowered to do that. So successful. And the providers also said, you know what, I do need to kind of do a better job educating and maybe bringing people up to speed in terms of what we're talking about. So, and there's a long discussion that any of you can bring up points from that discussion. They talk about limitations. We'll talk about that a little bit too, but we're just going to use this again to bring up the discussion, right? So Greg, I'm going to ask you first. I think this is fascinating to look at. Was there any result that I mentioned or that you read that surprised you the most, or this kind of, this fit overall what you feel about the situation with patients who get long-term injections? Or was there anything that was like, it's really interesting that providers felt one way versus patients who felt another?
I thought the thing that stood out the most that they did really well was that they actually separated it by disease entity, which I wasn't expecting to have that much of a difference, or maybe have the diabetic stand out more so from the vein occlusion patients combined with the AMD. I thought they'd be more similar. But the differences between how the patients felt like they wanted to be involved and not, and the providers perceived that they may not want to be involved. The difference between that and especially in AMD was kind of striking. And then the other thing was that, you know, the RVO patients really didn't know as much about the alternative therapies available, or if there was any injection fatigue or goals of therapy, they didn't really know why they were continuing on. And that sort of reflects a little bit of what I'm seeing in my practice, where I tend to get the most questions from AMD and RVO patients about why are we continuing to doing this, which is a tough question to figure out, like how many injections do I need and when do we stop? Whereas the diabetic patients tend to be a little bit more on board with understanding that they have a continuing disease that needs ongoing treatment.
You know, those are great points, Greg. Kat, the hard part with a study like this, I think it's fascinating to bring up this discussion. Like I said, the numbers are small, but pretty big. I mean, it's hard to survey that many patients, get them all to fill out the survey, all do these educational courses. You can imagine you could probably design a study without educational sessions that would not be as powerful, that simply just looked at perspectives and you could get maybe more patients to respond. But the hard part here to get to the point is we don't know what the vision is for these patients, right? So there's a very big difference from how a patient perceives care between a patient who has an RVO, who's 2100, gets that shot, magically they're 2025, and now they're maintaining 2025. And the patient who is 2400, count fingers, came in, ischemic RVO, got an injection, they're 2100, they're maintaining there, but they're still pretty unhappy about their vision. But in terms of what Greg said, how do you kind of interpret the differences between disease states? You would think some of this could be noise. Do you think there's actual realities between the conditions and the patient populations that define some of these differences?
Yeah, I mean, some of it I think is definitely noise. I mean, you have to think about that the patients who are interested in these sessions are a subset of our patients, right? Like there's some selection bias there of like who's willing to give up their time, you know, over lunch or like at the end of the day to attend a 1 hour session to learn more about their disease. So that's definitely not everyone sort of in your clinic. I think there's probably truth to it and that there's differences in different populations. I think the thing that I sort of admired most about this article is I think this is such an interesting concept. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel. I feel like I say the same things again and again all day long. And then I realize, you know, to like as one of my shortcomings that I'm probably not actually giving the full story to every patient, but in my head, it's sort of I did. And so it'd be nice to actually just have more time to sort of give your big spiel, you know, at once to a larger group of people. And so I really applaud them for this effort in general. I think this is a really good concept. I think it's just hard to sort of study in this format. I applaud them for sort of taking some stab at it, but I think it's an interesting concept, the shared decision-making, you know, type situation and having sessions. But I think the differences in between like entities should be explored a little bit more.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's interesting. We'll talk about in a minute what patients and doctors said about the challenges and sort of what they felt about communication. Actually, Kat referenced noise, and I think noise does play a role. She also referenced what we've all found is this idea of counseling patients multiple times, and yet they still don't quite understand things. And that means we're you could say that there's a gap there, that we are failing on some way to communicate the right way. Maybe a verbal conversation is not the way. Maybe it has to be written material. Maybe it has to be video. Maybe it has to be something beyond what we're doing. I also do wonder how much of this, for any of us who have personally experienced a health problem or have had a family member experience a health problem, you know, our interaction with them is such a small percentage of the time that they live with that problem, right? And if you've ever been in a situation, even if you just have a common cold, even if you rationally know that you're going to get better and someone says, okay, take this, you're going to get better, the doubts creep in, right? The doubts always creep in. We see this with every kind of retina patient, right? The retinal detachment patient with a gas bulb where you say, you know, it's going to go away and you're going to get a cataract. And when that comes out, you should see great. So most patients don't really believe it until they actually can see great, because part in the back of your mind is you're living with that problem every day. It's like, you know, I don't know if this is going to come back. I had a friend recently who's a physician who broke a limb, who can't use one of their limbs. And of course they know rationally it's going to heal, but there's still that fear kind of the back of your head. Well, maybe this isn't going to, what happens if it doesn't get better, right? That's, I think, normal. It's kind of normal psychology for anyone with this problem. My point is, for these patients, I don't know how much of it is a lack of understanding versus the doubt sort of creeping in over time. And that's, Kat referenced repetition. I think that's probably why repetition is so valuable. But I'm curious, I mean, do you have other thoughts on how you can best address it? Do you think this is a lack of communication? Or do you think that some of it is just, again, a patient just can't see as well as they'd like to? And so, of course, when they can't see as well, then maybe what the doctor told them in that 5 or 10 minute meeting just doesn't sink in the same way as the rest of their life, the rest of those weeks between their visits.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think it's probably, I'll weasel out and say it's probably a combination of all of the above. I think one thing that I find with a lot of my patients, I feel like I come in and I do their treatment and, you know, everyone seems happy. And I just assume that, oh, you know, they didn't really ask any questions. They probably don't have any questions. They kind of know exactly what we're doing, what the plan is. And then every so often I'm kind of thrown off guard when one of those patients says, well, why are we doing these again? I'm like, oh gosh, I feel like I've just failed you for the last several visits. And there might be there's this sense for some patients of, oh, I don't want to inconvenience my doctor by asking questions, or maybe I'm throwing off this body language where I look like I'm in a rush and they just don't want to ask the questions they have. So I think it's probably a combination of all those things. So I think I've over time kind of modified my follow-up spiel as well. So kind of reinforcing, you know, what we're doing, just kind of based on experience I've had with other patients, which have shown me my own shortcomings. So it's probably a combination of everything you mentioned, Jay.
That's a great point. I feel like I get now, especially, I don't think I lost a lot of weight, but I maybe lost a little bit of weight, but I think it's more wearing baggier scrubs, like post-COVID, we're all wearing scrubs. A lot more patients who are just like, oh, are you losing weight, doctor? Are you okay? And then I do think that they worry that they don't want to inconvenience or stress you, where you come in the room being like, I'm here to like have this encounter with you and help you, get you to where you need to go. And, you know, obviously part of your head is kind of like, I need to move on to the next encounter. It's human to kind of, part of being a retinal physician that's challenging is you have to kind of set aside that noise to focus on the person in front of you. You also have to remember that in the context of this really, really busy clinic, and then also do you need to keep moving? And I think you're right. I think patients are very perceptive of that. And for the most part, they're pretty generous with us, right? For the wait, the ratio of the time they wait to the time they spend with us is not as high as I think would be ideal. And I think for the most part, they're very forgiving of that. Obviously that will vary depending on where you practice in the patient population. I think your point about not worrying us is interesting. And I also have modified my follow-up spiel. I think a lot more of my follow-ups, even if they're just there for an injection, I say, okay, you know, just remember we're doing these injections. This is how we're doing it. I even bring up what could be down the horizon. Like if I think there's a new drug, I'm like, you're getting the best available therapy now. Could be better options in the future. This isn't for the rest of your life necessarily, but you know, this is until we have something better. And I kind of try to say those things every time, even if it feels redundant, because I do think that the amount absorbed versus something what someone tells you is low. I also think that they talk about here, patients talk about the biggest reason they feel like they stop being adherent to therapy is they don't feel like their vision gets better. And you can say in some, maybe some of those patients are right. Maybe their vision doesn't get better. Maybe they could come off treatment. Maybe there are some DME patients who are just stuck with bad vision because of drill or macular ischemia, and they don't need to continue treatment. But if you want to give the providers the benefit of the doubt, the reasons those patients are still getting treatment for AMD, RVO, DME, DR is not just to make the vision better, but to keep it from getting worse. And I think that's the preventative aspect. I've tried to be better about telling patients, hey, I know you're not seeing better. I understand that you're not seeing better. And if you can tell them that you understand that, maybe they're more likely to buy in. But the reason we're doing this is I don't want you to keep getting worse like you did before. Greg, I don't know if you have any thoughts on the adherence issue. And then we could also pivot a little bit to talking about whether patients want doctors to make decisions for them or not. I think there's been a lot of push in medicine over the last 15 years into avoiding paternalistic medicine to shifting into patients sort of being participants in the process. I mean, this study is based on the fact that you want to educate patients so they are more participants in their process. Yet most patients still seem to prefer, at least in this small cohort, that their doctors sort of make unilateral decisions or at least recommendations for them, and they like to follow that. What's kind of been your experience on either of those two? You can either start with talking about the reasons for adherence that were described here, the differences, or decision-making and who drives the decision-making.
Yeah, I agree. I think the challenge is trying to convince someone to continue on treatment even when their vision's not doing better. And I think the going back to someone who's like injured a limb or, you know, someone who's like torn their shoulder or something like that, I think the hardest thing is to convince them that they're doing well, even if they feel like their functionality is not very good. And that's the most visible thing for these patients is that an AMD patient who has like a permanent like area of atrophy next to their previous CNV that's being treated, or like an RVO patient that has persistent distortion due to a little bit of ischemia, all these patients are going to be like really bothered by that, especially if they're high functioning. So I think they're like kind of frustrated about like, well, I thought I was going to be back to normal. And I think recalibrating that idea of what their best baseline or where their plateau is kind of where I feel like I need to explain the most about like, this is the bestest we're going to do. And we need to keep you here by doing more injections. And it can be frustrating for that. But certainly, you know, showing them where they were or trying to help them remember where they were when they first met you, where they got the biggest gain, that's kind of where I think the money's at in terms of telling them, this is why we're doing the injections, because if we don't, we go right back to where you were. And, you know, to the second point, I think, yeah, you can really steamroll a lot of these patients in terms of just overloading them with information or just sort of like going like, well, this is the standard. We need to just do injections and just sort of going forward with that. And, you know, the interesting thing here was they were like, yeah, about a third of patients, they're just like, do what you want, doctor. You know, do what you think is best. Because they're coming to see us as a specialist. Some of them have been hyped up by their optometrists or ophthalmologists to come see us already. So they're ready for the specialist to weigh in on their opinion and take care of them. And it depends on, I think, the region that you're practicing in as well. You know, certainly not to say like the rural patients are less educated or, you know, less autonomous. But some of them still have that old school notion of the physician knows best and the physician is trying to do the best and is altruistic towards their patient. And, you know, depending on your region, that may or may not be true. But at the same time, I think that's like a benefit of, you know, interacting with those patients. They'll still think they want to be educated, but they're kind of like more like, you're the specialist, you've studied a long time for this. Please tell me what you think is best.
Yeah, terrific points. And your point about regions is right on. I mean, we've talked about this before, Kat. I always give the story of, you know, training in Miami, which is not rural, but it's got a mix of sort of that Southern culture plus the Latino / Islander culture. There's a strong culture of like the patriarchy, or not patriarchy is the wrong term, paternalism of medicine, where it's sort of, hey, I go to the doctor with the problem. I may be smart, I may be educated, but you tell me what to do, doctor, and I'll do it. And then, you know, when I went up north to Philly, where we both trained, I don't think it was to the level of Boston or New York or some of the stories of Palo Alto, Orange County, these very, very educated enclaves, but people are very, very individualistic about their care. But Philly was very much more people wanted to hear about the risks, they wanted to hear about the benefits, they wanted to sort of understand everything, even if they ultimately went with your recommendation, they wanted to know more. Then I moved back to Miami for my academic job, and I again shift my informed consent procedure, because in a way, like Greg said, some of these patients don't want to hear about everything. In a way, they're like, no, don't tell me about that. I don't want to hear about that. And sometimes I have to force them to be like, no, I have to tell you about these things so you know if they happen. So the cultural part is interesting. I think the shift is interesting. I think the mismatch here is interesting, though, because the regional part, you would imagine that over time that would even out. Meaning if you're a provider from a region where you're used to giving a long informed consent and really involving your patients, you know, if you go to a place where the patients sort of buy in after 5-6 years, you'd imagine that there would be kind of an equilibrium point. But there's a huge mismatch here between the providers and the patients, which I just wonder if it goes back to the whole thing again, not saying what you think you want, but not knowing you want. I do think if most of us, when we're in a scary situation, and vision loss is a scary situation, we kind of want somebody to tell us with certainty what's going to happen and what they're going to do. Unfortunately, all of us being doctors, we know that there are no certainties and we cannot ever promise anything, but that's not necessarily what a patient wants to hear when they're in that scenario. I wonder if some of this recommendation following a patient saying, I just want the physician to make a recommendation, is something about that certainty where if they say it this way, then I feel better that something's going to happen. But I'm curious about your thoughts again about that difference between the patients and the doctors.
Yeah, I think you made so many really good points there. And I think that there is this mismatch between sort of what the patients want and what we want. I think it was really striking in sort of the paper, you know, looking at the AMD patients, that was the biggest difference between what the providers thought patients wanted, which is for us to make decisions, versus what the percentage was among the patients, which is like only like 30% of them wanted us to make decisions. And I agree. I mean, I think that like when, you know, myself or one of my family members has something going on medically, like I want to go to the doctor and hear that everything's going to be okay. And this is what you can expect. And, you know, I do want to be guided to a certain extent, as long as I trust the person that I'm seeing. I think you sort of want to be able to have that, you know, that faith in the process. And I think that's what it speaks to a little bit. I think the other thing that I've found a little surprising, like, as you mentioned, you know, I trained in Boston and Philly, and those are both places where, you know, I felt a lot more time talking to people about the consent process. Patients spent more time doctor shopping. And then I'm now in the Midwest, which is a very different space. But even regionally, even when I go to different locations in the Cleveland Clinic area, it's dramatically different. And then if I see someone at like one clinic, like my clinic at main campus, there's sometimes I just spend more time on, you know, informed consent. There's a little bit more distrust among patients. If I have someone who's really trusting me, I almost always actually look at the chart again. And I was like, where are you from? Because it's just a difference depending on the day. And it's, I think it's just part of meeting patients where they are. And I think there's a lot to it, but you kind of on the fly need to sort of tailor sort of how you're approaching them and try and get a sense of what they're looking for.
That's a phenomenal, that regional variability. I think most retina specialists go to more than one office, actually. And I think we've all found that there's definitely offices, every office is different. Like, and that goes down again into the efficiency of your clinic. The number of patients you can see in a clinic varies differently between different clinics. And some of that is your infrastructure and your staff and what you have available resource-wise and space-wise. Some of that is the pathology you're seeing, the complexity, the percentage of new versus established patients, what those patients have. But some of that is just the patients themselves, like Kat says, like how much time you actually need to spend with each of these patients. And I think we all sort of figured that out in our individual practices over time. I think for the fellows who are listening to this maybe and are like, well, how do I know how much to tell people? I think that the one comfort I'll give you is there's an equilibrium that's reached probably. I think that if your consent process does not match what your patient has in their head, then they may find another provider. And that's okay. You know, that's okay for patients. I think you have to be okay with that. You can't take it personally when a patient prefers one doctor over you. I think that will happen to all of us. There's no physician in the world, except maybe your neighbor over there, Steve Charles, who gets preferred by every patient, every scenario, because patients are looking for different things. I've had some patients who complain about other doctors because they're like, well, they don't spend that much of the time with me. And I've had some patients say, I love this doctor because I know he must be really good and really busy at what he does because he doesn't spend any time with me. That's because he's really, really busy and he's just one of the leaders in his field. And it's like, okay, I mean, patients get what they like at some point. As long as they're happy and they feel supported and they get good care, then it really is up to them. Actually, any other thoughts on this? And I want to go back to self-awareness. You know, I made this joke about this earlier, and I'm not plugging another podcast just because we have a relationship or not, but I listen to other podcasts that aren't retina related, believe it or not. And one of the podcasts I was listening to on Hidden Brain, it was about self-awareness. And it was about how most of us are not self-aware, meaning that we have very good impressions. We can interpret what other people are like. We can look at someone else, be like, this is what you need, and this is what you need. It's really easy to make recommendations for someone else. We have very poor self-awareness about what we do well or not well sometimes. And that's true for most people. And that's true of physicians as well. I'm curious, again, how do you feel about the physician's self-awareness here? Because I again, the mismatch, patients aren't lying. They're telling you exactly what they think. But I would argue, and they didn't survey this, most of the doctors feel they're doing a pretty good job, and the nurses all of counseling. They're clearly not all doing a great job. They're failing. If you're at, you know, elementary or middle school with one of our kids, they'd be failing, right? So how do you introduce a component of self-awareness without being onerous, right? So we have press gaining and we have things like that where patients can leave their scores, but these things are kind of onerous. How would, like, if you were in your practice or if you were advising someone, hey, this would be a good way to set it up, how would you set it up in your practice where patients can actually feel like, hey, I can meet them halfway, because I may not know my weaknesses, but maybe my patients communicate this way that's more private, that's more kind of controlled, and then we can get better over time.
Yeah, that is so difficult because I think, like you said, just in part of this study, I mean, there's like a bias just inherent to which patients are going to kind of respond unless you're uniformly getting feedback from every single patient you see every single time, right? Just like similar to the volunteers in the study, there's probably an inherent bias there. I mean, I think one thing, you know, is I do, like, all of us probably have a little bit of a spiel that we kind of have each time we see our patients for both news and returns. And I've tried to take feedback that I've gotten and fold it into my next patient encounter. One thing I think, for an example, something that I've changed is, you know, for like my diabetics, right? You know, there's a lot of information I feel like I'm throwing at them all at once by the time they're in clinic with me. And as opposed to like maybe a patient with wet AMD and an RVO, I don't think, you know, delaying their treatment by a week or two or a couple weeks is necessarily, you know, gonna terribly impact their vision if it's just DME. So oftentimes I'll give them the information. I'll say, I just want you to mull this over, you know, for a couple weeks, and we're gonna come back and we'll start treatment the next time. And almost every single time I have that, they have so many questions the next time they come because they've had a little time to digest the information. They've had time to read up on it, and they don't feel like I've just injected them before they had a full sense of what's going on, because it kind of feeds back into, you know, if a patient doesn't understand what's going on, are they truly consentable to an injection, right? You'd hope that all your surgery patients understand exactly what's going on. If someone said after surgery, why did we do that surgery again? I feel like I'd be like kind of just floored. So that's one thing I folded in, but I don't know what other people do.
Kat, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the self-awareness piece is huge, you know. We all have feedback that we get. I don't know, I get emails from the Cleveland Clinic about feedback and positive and negative emails all the time. And, you know, it depends on the day if I want to read it or not. But I do think, you know, we constantly need to be learning. And I think this study sort of gets at, you know, we need to think about sort of what job we're doing, not only just about sort of the science of things, but actually sort of communicating. And we all could be doing a better job. And I know that there's some things in my sort of communication I could do better, but there's lots of things I have no idea that I could be doing a better job at. And sort of how do we bridge that gap? You know, it's, I don't quite know the answer to that question, but it's definitely going to make me think about things when I'm chatting with people tomorrow.
Well, let's transition. We spent a long time up front, but that's okay. I wanted to spend a long time. Let's transition to talking about one of these disease entities, which is retinal vein occlusion. The next couple articles are going to fixate and focus on that a little bit. The next article is about clinical trials in the context of retinal vein occlusion. Again, we've talked about a lot of these trials in the past. I think that we don't have to rehash all of the data here, but the authors here do a good job of discussing them. So again, the authors here, we have Nisarg Mehta and Susanna Park. They talk about laser photocoagulation going back to DVOS and CVOS. They talk about steroids, triamcinolone in the SCORE study, Giva for Ozurdex, and then they go into anti-VEGF. Bravo and Cruz for ranibizumab. You have your aflibercept trials with Galileo, Vibrant, Copernicus. And then you end with your bevacizumab trials here and talk about Levo a little bit, which is a comparative study comparing multiple anti-VEGF agents in the same trial. And then they talk about things about alternatives that are all kind of early phase one trials. We've talked about this before. I think phase one trials are interesting to talk about. Obviously, they're important down the line, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about them here. So I think the interesting things, Greg, that I think you take from trials is we forget some of the lessons from these trials, and we go and practice for 10 or 15 years, and then you go back and you talk about these trials. These trials, many of them predate us being retina specialists, right? These are older trials. I think some of the most interesting things I remember from these trials, I think the first one is BVOS, right? So we don't really do focal laser for vein occlusion. I mean, I guess some of you can chime in if you still do this. But I think one of the interesting lessons from BVOS is that a large percent of these macular edema from DRVO patients do not need long-term treatment, right? Their edema goes away past a certain point. So I'm curious, when you see a new BRVO patient, let's not talk about CRVO or HRVO, just a BRVO patient, what do you tell them when they come? Let's say they have vision loss, macular edema, BRVO. How many injections do you tell them they're going to get? you do a reassessment period? When do you start extending them? What are your general rules for BRVOs?
So for BRVOs, I'll start off with 3 monthly, but I'll extend quickly. If the after the first injection at the second visit, if they're flat and edema free, then I say, okay, we're going to 6 weeks. And I just extend as soon as we can. And so I guess it's more of like a, like almost some of these trials were intended to treat kind of if they were PRN. But I'll just treat and extend quickly. I just tell them we're going to be doing this for a while, a couple of years, but there is an end to it. And I think that's the carrot that you can dangle that encourages them to continue coming in. I think once they get to that 2025, 2030 vision level or better, and they're doing well, they're kind of wondering why they're still getting injections. And you can see the edema starting to creep back and you're kind of beating it back every once in a while with an injection. But it's hard to convince them, especially if they're like on a very frequent 5-6 week basis to keep coming in with good vision. And especially if they're young and working and having to take a day off from work. So realistically, I tell them, you know, we'll be on this for a few years and then, you know, we'll see what it looks like. But most of the time we can get you off of this. And if not, we can try, you know, steroid or some laser if that's like relevant in this situation. So,
Kat, no pun intended, I'm going to leave Levo for you because your colleague Rishi Singh has talked more about Levo than maybe anyone. Actually, again, we don't talk about CVOS much, but CRVOs behave differently. We know focal laser doesn't work for CRVOs. Again, very few people are doing focal laser. We know from an anti-VEGF standpoint that CRVOs tend to need longer term treatment than BRVOs. They tend to be more resistant to extension and be more resistant to stopping therapy. But PRP, so one of the things they talk about is CVOS talked about, if you had anterior segment neovascularization, you do PRP. I don't think there's a retina specialist out there, unless the eye, I guess, is NLP and it's comfort measures, who would say, no, don't PRP an eye that has anterior segment neovascularization. We know from other trials, like the trials done in RAVE, where if you have an ischemic retinal vein occlusion with NVI and you inject them, you still end up needing to do PRP later because the NVI comes back when you stop treatment with anti-VEGF. But the interesting thing is they talk about these disc areas, right? So that's old school, right? They used to do these FAs and montage them and say, hey, if you have 10 disc areas, you memorize this for your OCAPs and your boards, then you do laser, you're high risk at that point. Now we have ultra wide field FA, we're all getting optos, and I don't know how many of us are actually counting disc areas. We're probably seeing more of the retina we did before. Those 10 disc areas are probably present in a lot of vein occlusions now that we just didn't see before. Do you ever PRP eyes, Akshay, that don't ever demonstrate anterior segment neovascularization? Or is it a strict rule? Are there any scenarios where you would PRP an eye even if there was never any signs of NVI or NVA?
Yeah, great question. So a couple things. You know, we've done a couple studies on answering some of these questions. So the first thing is that, you know, a lot of us probably get a baseline FA. I don't know how many of us are repeating FAs. I don't repeat FAs on patients for whom they're undergoing active anti-VEGF therapy, but at least in vein occlusions, a lot of the areas of ischemia you see later on, they develop with time. So they may not be present initially, especially if someone that doesn't have a chronic vein occlusion. If I'm considering stopping anti-VEGF therapy because their ischemia is completely gone, or they just have, like you just said, macular ischemia, I just think their vision is just not going to get any better, I'll do an FA at that point of time. If they have significant non-perfusion, then I will tell them, I think it makes sense to do a vein occlusion because I suspect there's a good chance you could get neovascularization. I prefer not to follow you, you know, every 2 months to monitor for if and when that happens. So in those patients, if they have severe ischemia, I'm stopping anti-VEGF therapy. As a prophylactic, I'll probably do a light PRP.
Yeah, smart. And again, I the other scenario I like it is if someone already had NVG in the fellow eye from an RVO. We have some of these bilateral CRVO patients more likely to offer it. So Kat, as promised, Levo. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the anti-VEGF trials because they essentially all just show that anti-VEGF works, although I'm sure there's a lot of post-hoc analyses and digging deep. But Levo is interesting because you compare bevacizumab, ranibizumab, aflibercept head-to-head-to-head for retinal vein occlusion. Like I mentioned, your colleague, Dr. Rishi Singh at Cleveland Clinic, was very involved in talking about this and this original sort of some real passion of his. I'm sure you've heard a lot about it. If you actually look at the analyses, it's always one of those interesting things where you have three graphs, right? It's like protocol T. You have the graph for aflibercept, you have the graph for ranibizumab, the graph for bevacizumab, and there's no significant differences between each line, but then the difference between the outer lines between aflibercept and bevacizumab are starting to get, it's the non-inferiority analysis, but it's starting to reach that significant non-inferiority analysis, right? But the letter difference is fairly small, right? You're talking about 5 letters on average at 100 weeks, that's one line. So my question, Kat, did Levo change how you approach RVO? Do you start patients on bevacizumab? Do you switch them earlier? Do Do you prefer aflibercept over ranibizumab? Do you think it matters which anti-VEGF you use for these patients?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I agree with you. I mean, I've given talks about Levo and Score 2 before. And I feel like every time I do it, I have to like spend a lot of time looking at those slides and the methods because it becomes very confusing very quickly. And then all the secondary analyses that they did, like I'm like, so it's not non-inferior. And I was like, what does that mean in my brain? Like how much coffee did I have this morning for things? You know, I have to say, I don't think that Levo changed, I think, what medications I start on. And to be honest, I sort of use for like RVO patients in general, like at the clinic, we usually start most of our patients on Avastin and then we sort of switch over if we need to, which is kind of sort of our culture here and also just part of sort of, our insurance here. I think about switching agents in RVO patients when I feel like I'm having to see them more frequently than I would like to see if I can get sort of longer. And it's less, I think, of how much of the fluid is going away if they have persistent fluid. It's more like a duration sort of issue. So I think the Levo studies are interesting and, you know, maybe I should think about them and let them impact my practice a little bit more. But I don't know. I think when you do that many sort of post-hoc analyses, it just kind of becomes confusing, especially when, you know, Levo was structured differently than like Score 2.
Yeah.
It's hard to sort of compare things sort of head to head.
Yeah. The real question is whether Levo or Score 2, they were helpful in a sense because there were drastic differences. So you can say in some sense, it's helpful to look at it because you know, there's not a drastic difference, but it's one of those studies that it would be more helpful if there was a drastic difference. The fact that it's sort of this non-inferiority like wash where it's like, well, it may be better, but not clearly, it makes you feel good because they all work. But it doesn't, like you said, change management. I agree with it. You know, I'll just volunteer my one learning lesson from these trials. You know, SCORE talked about 1 milligram versus 4 milligram triamcinolone. So that's volume wise, if you have 4 milligrams for 0.1, that's what 0.1 versus 0.025. And that was for retinal vein occlusion. And it showed the efficacy was equal, but the complication rate was lower for 1 milligram. I think this is something that we don't talk about a lot as a field. And actually, I'm sure you have thoughts as a uveitis specialist, but I actually think that's helpful because even for non-RVO indications, if I have CME, if I have DME, I will oftentimes start with either 1 or 2 milligrams as a starting dose when I use treat a patient. Let's say they have severe glaucoma and we're just testing before we put the injection. Let's say they've never had a tube and glaucoma is like, please don't make them need a tube. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to try a little bit. I'll use a small volume because I know the efficacy can be there based on that, at least for RVO. Maybe it translates to other conditions. Maybe it doesn't. And then you don't necessarily have to jump straight to a full dose or even a half dose. You could probably do a quarter or a third dose and get some efficacy. But actually, any thoughts on that as a uveitis specialist?
By the time I'm pulling the intravitreal steroids, we're going for full effect. So with uveitis patients. So yeah, I think the one thing I'd say with uveitis for us, you know, our leading cause of vision loss is undertreated CME, right? So I'd sooner put steroids in a tube than undertreat their CME for a uveitis patient. So it's maybe not apples to apples, but that's how I would do for a uveitis patient. And I never give them less than a full dose.
Well, let's translate to laser. I mean, we have another study on laser combination laser anti-VEGF for retinal ischemic areas by Nitish Mehta and Yasha Modi from NYU. Their subtitle gives away the crux of the paper, which is that targeted laser approach may not enhance treatment effect. Hashtag spoilers at the front. But Greg, these are from your former colleagues at NYU. Just to summarize, they talk a little bit about the thought used to be, and I remember this conversation, was that if you did targeted laser to ischemic areas, you may either extend or reduce need for anti-VEGF treatment for diabetic macular edema or even retinal vein occlusion associated edema. And there's been multiple studies over the years. And this goes back to our discussion with the first article. Why? It's because we as physicians really want to reduce the treatment burden on these patients. The thing that's interesting, and you look at all these different studies, when you really look at it, it doesn't really seem to drive down your need for treatment, right? So targeted laser doesn't seem to be something that is reducing the treatment burden in DME. And again, they focus more on DME here, but I brought in RVO as well, since we just talked about it. Are there scenarios, Greg? I asked actually the same thing about NVI. Are there any scenarios where you'll add PRP anyway? Are there any times when you say like, well, yes, 90% of the data shows this, but there are a couple studies that have shown reduced treatment burden doing this. I'll try this. Do you ever throw in focal laser in a BRVO patient on top of your injections? What percentage of your BRVO patients are or RVO patients are getting laser at this point, assuming they don't have neovascularization?
I think the interesting thing about this article is, and just sort of the summary of all the non-perfusion studies, is that thank God we don't have to do ultra-wide field FAAs on every patient that has like an RVO and DME, because if we had to do targeted laser on each one of them, it'd be a lot of burden to clinic, and we'd be doing a lot more FAs than I think we otherwise would be. And so, you know, it sort of goes back to a little bit of the first article that we were talking about, where, you know, what's your usual spiel on diabetic macular edema and retinal vein occlusion? Usually say it's because of all this ischemia that it drives up the VEGF load, and then we have to treat that with an injection. But this sort of laughs in the face of that and says it's not the ischemic areas, it's a diffuse, like, pan-retinal disease. And so it just sort of goes to show that, you know, the thing that makes sense to us is not necessarily the truth here for these diseases. I think for RVO, I'm less likely to do, you know, focal or sectoral PRP. But for diabetics, I'm sort of all for doing some focal if you find focal leakage areas in the macula, and then doing targeted focal for those. And then for doing like a sector of PRP, if there's like a particularly ischemic area. But I'm more likely, if I'm going PRP, I'm going full, or, you know, all the way. And I'll sort of start more peripheral from mid periphery outwards, and then work my way in, depending on the load. And I usually reserve that for people who just, you know, there's, I can't really say what they look like, but they look really severe NPDR without a lot of blot hemorrhages. And it just sort of looks to me like, you know, really ischemic tissue, more so than someone who has like a lot of blot hemorrhages and sort of some perfusion reperfusion injury. If they're really ischemic, but then they have some trace NV, or like if they have just, you know, really bad like ischemic macula, you know that they're going to be in trouble soon.
Yeah, great point. And Winefield FA helps us there. And a lot of the data from Protocol W and Panorama says those patients are pretty high risk for developing PDR type complications at a year or 2 years. Kat, just following that thought and to wrap up this idea of laser, what about you? Do you ever apply? I mean, severe NPDR seems like a reasonable point where some people will add laser, and Greg brought up reasons why you might do that. Any other scenarios we'll add laser trying to target macular edema, whether it's focal laser or peripheral laser, whether it's an RVO or DME?
I don't really. I mean, I agree with Greg that, you know, I don't think we focal as much now, obviously, as our more senior colleagues do. And, you know, I remember when I was in fellowship, I'm sure the attendings at Wills sort of told you the same thing, but a bunch of our attendings are like, make sure you focal now, because if you don't focal now, you will not focal moving forward. And I feel like focal for DME does have a role, especially, you know, it can decrease sort of the burden. You know, you can see sort of a couple MAs just leading to a lot of exudates. So that's, I think, is still a nice tool to have in your toolbox. I don't really sort of PRP for the sake of the edema, but sort of, I think Greg made an excellent point that sort of I agree with. You know, I'm always surprised, I think, in the age of sort of wide field FA sometimes about what the FAs show on diabetics. And sort of one of the big teaching points I sort of always tell our fellows and our residents, if you see that there's NV and there's not really like hemorrhage out on the periphery, like just be careful of what the FA shows, because it's often super illustrative. You know, and if I see sort of those findings in one eye and the other eye is not advanced, I usually tend to be more aggressive on the other eye if I'm doing PRP. So I think it's definitely helpful. But I don't really PRP just for DME for decreasing sort of burden.
Well, it's the moment Akshay Thomas has been waiting for. It's the only reason he decided to come after a busy UBAD clinic and spend time with us. He likes you, Greg. He likes you, Kat. I'm not sure he likes me, but this is why he's here. He's here because the last article is a deep dive into uveitis practice. Four of his colleagues contributed little pearls for the uveitis community. And Greg, I am going to zag where they zigged. I'm going to ask you a question that has nothing to do, Akshay, I'm going to ask you a question that has nothing to do with these questions they asked, because I think this is all really interesting. People can go read it and learn a lot about uveitis. So my question for you, Akshay, number one, how did they get away without mentioning Headlight in the Fog, the premier uveitis podcast in the ophthalmology community, which should be in this article? But second, what about, let's talk about a practical consideration. We talked about this a little bit in the past one-on-one. We have fellows who are like, you know what, I want to do uveitis as part of my practice. I did a uveitis fellowship. I'm going to go into practice. They're negotiating with their academic center. They're negotiating with their managed health organization. They're negotiating with their private practice or private equity organization. How do they protect themselves from getting burned out and getting consumed? How do they protect themselves from getting undervalued and from getting, you know, not appropriately compensated or appreciated for the work they're doing that doesn't bring in the same RVU value as doing 30 injections in, you know, Kat Talcott's or Greg Lee's clinic? How do you get yourself to a situation where you obviously don't be confrontational about it, but you build in sort of protections for yourself where you can have a sustainable balance and career? And how do you maintain the percentage of retina that you want to see when everyone else in your practice wants you to see uveitis?
Those are all fantastic questions. And I'd say there's something that we discuss frequently to people that are coming out into practice, or at least we counsel each other as either combined anterior segment uveitis or retina uveitis people are coming out into practice. So I think the first thing is that you try to say upfront what you want your uveitis volume to be. All right. So there's some people that might say, I want to do 50-50. For me, I try to stay more like, you know, 70-30. Part of it also depends on your compensation model, right? There's some practices where it is eat what you kill. And like you said, your productivity from uveitis, just in terms of what you're billing, but also just in the number of patients you're able to see, is going to be lower. So in a situation like that, you might want to shield yourself and saying, I want to see a lower percentage of uveitis patients, but there might be practices where everything is split, you know, right down the middle, right? So there you have say, well, I'm happy to see as much uveitis patients as I need to see, as long as I'm still seeing some retina and doing some surgery. So that those parts are kind of practice specific. In terms of, you know, kind of making sure you don't get overrun, I think it's something you have to discuss with your partners, right? At once, when you find yourself going past whatever threshold you've set, you say, it's time, we got to find another uveitis person to join practice. Either that, or we need to change the way that we're compensating ourselves or our model, because people understand that it's not just that you're seeing the more complicated patients, you're generating new referral streams, which you may not have had previously, right? You know, I think for every complicated patient that you're willing to see, people are willing to send you more straightforward stuff as well, right? So you're also kind of clearing up other people's clinics, because, you know, just having two uveitis patients in your retina clinic can really kind of throw a damper on your flow. So by offering to offload those to your friendly uveitis partner, you're kind of freeing up other people's clinics. So most people understand that and are willing to kind of, you know, create models which incentivize you to see these more complicated patients, but it's definitely not across the board.
Great advice. Great points. I wonder, actually, I'm curious, do you ever wrap your slots differently? Like my point is, do you have separate slots in your clinic for uveitis and retina to avoid? Because the complaint I get so much from uveitis colleagues is, hey, I just keep getting uveitis patients booked in by whoever's taking the calls from referring doctors at the front desk, whatever. I never get retina referrals because they just don't send retina referrals to me. All my clinics are filled with uveitis. How do you sort of build in those percentages where it's actually functional in a practice?
It's a great question. So the first thing that most of us do is that we'll say that we want to see uveitis at a specific office. And typically that's the office where we have the best equipment, right? So, you know, everything from our slit lamps to our fundus cameras, to our ability to process aqueous samples, labs around the area vary location. So for me, for most new uveitis patients, unless they're coming from, you know, hours away, I'm going to see them at my main office. So by nature, the majority of my new patients at my main office are uveitis patients, and at my satellites are bread and butter retina. So that kind of takes care of that problem for the most part.
Greg and Kat, anything besides thanks for our uveitis colleagues who take care of uveitis patients so we don't have to?
Much thank you, Akshay.
Yeah, really thank you for taking on some of these super challenging patients. I think it's really interesting in any practice model to, because we are subspecializing within retina, even like a super subspecialty, like, you know, you have uveitis people, you have pediatric retina people, you have tumor people. And how do you not penalize those people for taking on these super complex cases? And, you know, I think we have sort of a little bit more of a pooled model where if you're going out and starting a new location, for instance, you're going to take a hit on your percentage and your productivity. But since it's more pooled than eat what you kill, then there's no sort of penalty to that. And it's almost more encouraged to do that kind of stuff that's helpful for the practice. Same thing with taking on like the specialty guys. Like, you know, we have one guy who does tumors and it's thankless work, but at the same time, he's not getting penalized for seeing less patients in the day than we are.
Great points.
Yeah, I think this article, and I think, you know, brought up some things that I just don't think about. Like, you have to have a system for tracking labs. Like, how do you do that in private practice? Like, I think there's so many sort of unseen complexities to sort of taking care of these patients. So much thank you to you and your colleagues for taking care of these patients for us.
Yeah, I'm amazed that private practice people can do really high level uveitis with the integration and sort of coordination that it requires, talking to other providers, things like that, charting every day.
Very true.
Yeah. The last, I just wanted to point out one or two things from the article, which is kind of hidden in there, but are super important. One thing is that despite all the grumbling that we do as uveitis specialists, we'd still much rather see patients early in their disease course than late in their disease course. You know, so no shame in sending it over to your friendly uveitis practitioner. And the second thing is that about 50% of the time, we don't know exactly what we're treating, in the sense, you know, patients have a great case of something and we're not quite sure what it is. And that's a totally normal feeling to have, you know, as a new uveitis person out there. Kind of most important is to know what you don't know, right? So if you're confident you know what you don't know, then you're fine.
Great points. Greg Lee, Kat Talcott, Ashley Thomas, thanks so much for joining us. Check out Headlight in the Fog. Even if the article didn't reference it, we're going to reference it here. And have a great day, guys. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Trey. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Trey.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Drs. Lee, Talcott, and Thomas for joining us for this podcast episode. Remember, all 342 of our episodes can be found on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find them sorted by category, easily searchable, archived. You can go all the way back, years back, and listen to episodes about pearls and tips and topics. This was a great discussion today, and hopefully continue to provide that great content going forward for a long time in the future for all of you. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can contact us in many ways to give us ideas for episodes or to give feedback. Remember, you can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or click on the Contact Us link on our website. And please, anytime you have a chance, leave a review in the Apple Store. Those are always great and give us good feedback to move forward for the future. Thanks again to our production team. That includes Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benincasa. Thank you, listeners, for all you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and the patients you take care of, the lives you change every single day. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.